So let's just make this a little bit fun. I'm going to give you a quiz. Okay. So which one is real and which one is fake? Who says Obama? Who says Trump?
Real or fake?
Real or fake? Video. Wait, let's try that again. Sorry. There's no audio on that, don't worry. There's no audio in the first shows. Who thinks Obama is real and who thinks Trump is real? Okay, Obama's fake. Okay, now you're gonna look at this one. Same thing. Who is fake? How many? I'll say guy and girl. Guy? Girl? All right, girls win it, and indeed the girl's fake. Okay, and what about these videos?
Ah,
both real. Okay, one more. May or Putin?
They're both fake.
Theresa May is fake. And of these ones, which one's fake? One on the right. So, if you've even guessed correctly in every video, whatever, just imagine applying that to, you know, scrutiny to every piece of video, right? That's the kind of state we're in now. And I'm going to just show you a little bit of how this was made. It was kind of fun to see.
It got me thinking about my full-time employees and their ability to survive on $8 an hour in New York City. And foremost in all of our minds has been the loss and the grief felt by the people of Orlando. Most of us don't get our health care through the marketplace. We get it through our job or through Medicare or Medicaid. And what you should know is that, thanks to the Affordable Care Act, your coverage is better today than it was before. Women can get free checkups, and you can't get charged more just for being a woman. To give his employees work together to pass a comprehensive bill that would boost America's very, very hard times.
Some progress, at least within the small confines of the legal community. I think it's real important.
Here we go. President Barack Obama, when you were giving a speech,
he's a puppeteer there. Amazing, right? So even like in the videos, you just can't even tell, right? Which is fake and which is real. And it's kind of astonishing at the point which we've gotten to. And it's not just that kind of puppeteering you're seeing. This company, Pinscreen, is even more intense. Because they can just use one image. Ready?
The most realistic computer-generated characters. Think of a young Princess Leia's appearance in that
one photograph on the left.
But what if smartphone users
being driven
the same
by this mouse on the right?
Today, researchers are developing software that harnesses artificial intelligence to generate lifelike but fake footage. Startups like LA's Pinscreen only need one selfie to start modeling the facial features of a video avatar.
So this is the guy who, one of the team who just won the prestigious Turing Award for their AI work. And he says that the dangers of abuse are very real in the AI world, right? He says killer drones are a big concern, surveillance, which we've all talked about, and also another issue is that AI can actually divide society further by creating discrimination and biases, right? So how does that reflect, right, in AI in the real world? Well, recently Amazon was taking all these, you know, resumes in, realized they were hiring many more men than women, and then found out that their AI recruitment tool was looking for words, capture and execute. And women weren't putting capture and execute on their resumes. And the guys who made the AI were actually putting in their own biases without even realizing it. So there's a lot of stuff here that you have to think about it. But now I'm going to take you a little bit in a different journey. I'm going to tell you a little bit about how I've used technology kind of in reverse. I'm using recreation for real stories. So I had done a lot of work as a journalist on Guantanamo Bay Prison. But here's a place, you know, that you're denied access, right? So how do you report on a place like that? Well, we made a virtual but accessible version of Guantanamo Bay Prison. It was originally built in Second Life, and it ended up at the Moscow Museum of Modern Art in 2013. This is a photograph that soldiers smuggled out of Gitmo in the way the detainees were being brought to Gitmo, and this is what it looked like in our virtual space. And here's a little video on kind of how the things work.
I was thrown into the back of a C-17 transport plane and...
You are immediately bound, and then a black hood comes over the vision of your avatar.
Shut up!
We then integrated some sounds that were based on descriptions of what real detainees heard. When the black hood is removed, you find that you're in a cage.
So that was the earliest piece I ever did, trying to think about how do you take real data that I had from the Freedom of Information Act and turn it into journalism. And then I got a job working as a research fellow at USC, and the students were working on what would it be now kind of, at the end of time, it was innovative to put in text, video, audio, et cetera, into web journalism, and we were working on a piece on hunger in the Golden State. And I wanted to use virtual reality. This probably didn't even have GoPro cameras, right? And I asked the students what they want to work on with me. Nobody raised their hand. I found this high school graduate who was just graduating. And together we started recording audio at food banks until this real day where a man with diabetes didn't get food in time and he collapsed into a diabetic coma. And I had to recreate the entire scene. This guy, John Brennan, played every character for me because we had to put motion capture data, obviously fake movement, but based on the material and the audio that we had. And this is how I directed him to make that piece, right? And this was the piece that came out. Audio is all real.
Okay, we have a seizure. Okay.
Could you turn on the audio for me for a second? So the man on the right in those goggles, those crazy goggles, he's there clearly down with the seizure victim, even though he's wearing that intense hardware, being very careful not to step on the body. That piece ended up getting into the Sundance Film Festival, the first VR piece ever at Sundance. And these were the only goggles I had, and the head of the lab was like, "That's, you know, those are $50,000 a pair, you're not taking them to Sundance, no way." So we had to make goggles, and that's us in the lab trying to figure out how to make something we could take with us. And those little black dots you can see on the screen, that's called your IPD, like where your eyes are set. And I had a really skinny head, and that guy with his face in the mask had a really fat head. So we were arguing over, you know, how the goggle lenses should look. But this is what they showed, what we showed up with. It's a huge thing. And just as a quick word of note, that kid with the fat head was named Palmer Luckey, and 9 months after the Sundance event, he started Oculus Rift and then sold the company for $3 billion. But this is what it looked like when we were figuring this all out. And this was opening night at Sundance, and we had no idea how people were going to react, right? And again, we found that as the man was on the ground having a seizure, that people would go down on the ground. It didn't matter that, you know, they could see out the sides. But they were incredibly deeply immersed in this completely fake recreated scene, right? And the reactions were astonishing. This is her coming out of the goggles, and you might recognize her. She became a famous actress.
Oh, you're crying. You're crying. Gina, you're crying.
So, but this has happened over and over and over again, right? People down on the ground trying to talk to the seizure victim. And here's the weird thing, you guys. People put their own, I don't know what it is, into story. Like, people won't say to me, "Hey, man, I knew that was a seizure victim." No, remember, I spent $700 of my own money making this thing and had to become a better C-sharp coder. Like, I had donated virtual humans. And people came to me and said things like, "I could tell that was a seizure victim because his knees were all scuffed up." Or the woman in the orange, she goes and she starts stealing food in the chaos. I could tell she was a heroin victim by the needle marks on her arm. I mean, wild, right? But I guess this is the famous tortilla of the Virgin Mary that people have said the Virgin Mary image. It's amazing what we can put into things, right? What we read as humans, right? But, you know, deep fakes are really already all around us. They're used in commerce in an unexpected way. How many of you are familiar with Lil Miquela, the Instagram star, right? Completely faked. And her company is now worth at least $125 million, the company that makes her. And other people are getting into the business of that, of course, not surprisingly. Of course, fun and entertainment. I mean, we know this already, right? We know what CG looks like. I mean, that elephant of Dumbo is so beautiful. I mean, other than the blue eyes, the realness of it continues to astound. And then even love, right? So this guy married the hologram. He fell in love with her and he decided to marry her. And as I was trying to find a good picture from her, I stumbled onto this. Japanese man marries hologram, but Kondo's mother refused an invitation to her only son's wedding in Tokyo this month. I mean, that's what happens when you marry a hologram, I guess, right? So then he, like, in the same way that Gitmo was starting to have these ideas about how to take recreations, etc., the question is whether recreations can lead us to truth, right? This was sent to me by a friend who's a quantum physicist, and this was the most important physics meeting in the world. And he went to the Trump session on science, and this is the room that he found, completely empty, nobody there, right? Kind of scary. We, on the other hand, were working on a piece on climate change, which has been difficult to get people to accept as being real, right? And then, I'm gonna show you a trailer. It should have started then. I'm gonna go back, sorry, because there should be a trailer here. Not starting for me. There we go.
Well, when you look at the glacier like that from vantage point of an helicopter, it looks like it's gonna be here forever. How could it possibly go away?
Retreated more in the last 15 years than in the previous 70 years. We'd like to know why.
Truth, right? And how did we make it? So we clamped a 360 camera to an edge of a helicopter, and we flew over Greenland, and we filmed real footage, right? But then we made CG models of the helicopter. So the model of the helicopter is fake, and then we put that footage into a sphere around the helicopter so that you feel like you're really flying over Greenland, right? And you're not really. And yet you really are, right? At the same time, if we believe film to be truthful, right? And then working with that team, obviously they're used to documentary, and I was trying to explain to them about photogrammetry and how you capture things with intense realism. And unfortunately we got some material like this, which is a flat photograph, and we had to, in our studio, actually turn it into something volumetric. And this just gives you an idea of the process of doing that. We had to literally kind of ask the program to understand the dimensionality that we were trying to express here and then create something that people could walk around. And the end result was this, right? Now, we also took the NASA scientists and we filmed them in studios of 8i in Los Angeles. And there was a bit of discussion, like, what do they wear? Right? We can't put them in parkas because we're filming them in LA, or else the people think we're going to be filming them in Greenland, and we didn't really film them in Greenland. And then we made beautiful photogrammetry models, meaning photo real, full walk around, exact replica of the NASA airplane that was flying around, that flies around there normally, but was on the ground when we shot them. And the NASA scientist was like, I want to wear my blue jumpsuit. And there was all this discussion back and forth, but like, if he wears his blue jumpsuit, are we going to tell the audience? That are they going to be fooled into thinking that we filmed him on his airplane and was flying over Greenland when we didn't? And in the end, he's like, well, anytime I'm in my airplane, I'm in my jumpsuit. I'm wearing my jumpsuit to be filmed. So it was kind of an interesting question about like when you're merging these realities for documentary, you know, what's sort of true or not. And if you talk about fake, we put you underwater. Because actually one of the reasons why this is so important, this piece, was that the melting of the glaciers is happening at a pace that shouldn't be just from the sun melting them from above. And what they're realizing, their data that they're collecting, that the seas are warming and they're melting them from underneath, and that's what's contributing to the rise of the water. So we did some studies with people. We made a flat video, just regular video. We did 360 video, and then we did full walk-around headset, and we tested people's reaction and found that when they were walking around the enormity, the understanding of being next to a glacier when it melts, you really understand the information more clearly. I think that's really important. When you're in that airplane with that guy and he's dropping that tube down there within the jumpsuit, what he's doing, he's dropping a temperature. And it's kind of like, oh, I could be in the back of the airplane and drop, you know, a probe down next to the toilet, right? And imagine it hitting the water. And it's not just scientists in their cubby holes making stuff up. So we use the virtual reality actually to kind of tell the truth of the science. And since that time, and I'm not going to talk too long about this, but if anyone wants to know more about this, please come see me afterwards. I mean, we'll do some I'm going to make sure we have plenty of time for Q&As, but. We've been building a platform and a distribution tool set to let other people make their own volumetric content themselves to try to see what other ways this walk around content, which is very powerful, stories can be told. And on the left, they're just buttons. I had to become a better C# coder, but that just isn't the case anymore. Here's a little trailer that we made with the guest appearance of a friend who's here tonight, too.
Introducing Reach, the first web platform for creating and sharing volumetric VR using real people and places. Built by the pioneers at Emblematic Group, Reach is an easy-to-use, browser-based solution that makes the power of walk-around VR available to anyone. Reach lets you craft your own volumetric stories in three easy steps using a simple drag-and-drop interface. First, you access a library of 3D locations, many of them captured using stunning high-resolution photogrammetry. You can also upload locations you have created yourself. Then, use our simple tool to add your own real-life video interviews, volumetric characters, or 3D assets. Finally, you can share the results via a simple web link. No need for downloads or dedicated apps. Reach eliminates all the distribution barriers facing room-scale VR. Viewers can navigate stories on a smartphone, tablet, or PC, or put on a headset and walk around for full immersion. Sign up now to discover how far you can reach into the future where the stories we tell are as vivid and three-dimensional as the world we inhabit.
True. So how many people here have heard of the bystander effect? So the bystander effect holds, and it's taught in all the psychology books, that when there are more people standing around a situation occurring, that everybody thinks someone else is going to call the police and they don't get involved, right? So this team, which actually introduced me to VR with this piece coming up, this is Mel Slater, Maria Sanchez Vives, who are out of Barcelona, they decided to take a look at that, you know, whether that was true or not, right? And of course you can't put people on the side of something where, you know, a real event where people are, you know, beating somebody. But in this particular case, with a third researcher, they got access to all the closing time footage of pubs in England, because of course they've all the CCTVs. And using the audio and images to really, really construct the piece, inform how they constructed the piece, basically, the guy in the red football jersey walks in, the guy is drunk in the white jersey, and he, you know, starts to assault him. And I, you know, this is my first walk around VR piece when I tried this, is, you know, a decade ago or more now. Anyway, and I remember just pulling on the headset because I like, wanted to get into, like, what was going on, right? Well, here's the amazing thing. They found in their results that is simply not true. The more people were on scene, the more likely it was that somebody would try to intervene, both in terms of the footage and in terms of the study. Right? And they also found in this study of the footage, that if I have stopped you from intervening, then all hell would break loose, right? And the final part of this was in about a third of all the cases that one of the bystanders would walk up to the perpetrator, clock him once, and that would be the end of it. So anyway, those are the kind of the different options. But just this year, in 2016, the New York Times revisited their story on that case, right? The portrayal of 38 witnesses was erroneous, the article grossly exaggerated, in fact, people did try to get involved, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's really hard once you have something like the bystander effect, it's so neat and so easy for us to understand, to uncheck those boxes, right? It's once you get misinformation or disinformation into our ecosystem, how do you undo it? And I'm not sure that I have solutions, but I'm gonna keep talking to you about how this happens in all different kinds of ways. This is a photograph of Osama bin Laden's assassination, right? Well, this is a photograph on the left of, in a lot of places in the Middle East, actually photoshopped the women out of the room because women, of course, couldn't be with men. So we see this in all kinds of different, you know, obviously we know that the written word, film, et cetera, has been used for propaganda and fake information and other things like the Rosetta Stone, which is used for collecting taxes. But there are people trying to combat this. They're trying to figure out how to sort of fight this disinformation. And if you want to take a picture of that, or I think we're going to distribute some of the slides. But there are at least 175 fake news sites that have been identified, which makes it tough, because 82% of middle schoolers can't tell whether something's fake, real, sponsored. And I've been on this commission with the Knight Foundation all year and the Aspen Institute on trust, media, and democracy. And I would have to say that we as journalists have to take some responsibility to make sure that that sponsored content is clearly differentiated from the real content. We have to make the situation as clear as possible on our end, if it's an opinion or it's real stuff, as much as anything else, right? This is, you know, a lie can travel half around the world while the truth is putting on its shoes. Actually, Mark Twain didn't say that, so it's a lie. But it's true in that an MIT study indicated that when they looked at about 3 million people post, right, that it spread 1,000, the truth rarely diffused more than 1,000 people, whereas false news cascaded between 1,000 and 100,000 people. So, you know, we spread fake news really fast. Rumor is good. But the thing about that stuff is it means that all of us are not trusting the information, right? And currently trust in the major institutions in America are crumbling. And it's really affecting our democracy, right? Without trust, democracy cannot function. So I show this to kind of think about, like, what are we hearing, you know, and all this misinformation and stuff. Well, we know that attacks are up. Anti-Semitic incidents in the United States increased nearly 60% from 2016 to 2017. I mean, that's the kind of world we're living in, where these words matter. In Rwanda, when the genocide happened there, there was a guy on the radio, and he was really basically perpetuating this hateful language about killing each other, et cetera, of one ethnic group going after the other. But now they have a soap opera in which they intermarry. Words matter. They really matter what you say. And I truly believe we're not meant to be this way. We're not meant to be that people who are saying all this horrible stuff. I really think that kindness can prevail, even if the kindness is kind of fake. Well, so let me explain what I mean by that, right? What if the placebo effect is not a trick? This is what's really interesting, right? We know the placebo effect works, but guess what? If you're kinder to people when you're administering the placebo effect, if you distribute it with caring and warmth, it's much more effective. So, like, this whole thing about being fake, the whole thing needs to be thought about in this very different approach, right? So, in conclusion, we need trust, but you need to verify. Believe it or not, this is a Russian idea. And Reagan made it well-known in the United States. So, you know, I think it's a good thing to adopt. I think the Russians probably know. Trust and then verify. Really, truly think before you share. Have critical thinking. Try to teach critical thinking. This is an important moment for all of us to do that. And finally, instead, spread goodwill. It can help battle disinformation. Thank you very much. I left a few minutes for questions if people had questions. Anybody?
Raise your hand if you have a question. I'll come over to you with a microphone.
It's going to come up with the mic. Here we go. There's somebody here.
Here we go.
In there.
Hold on a second.
So the volumetric that you did from the flat surfaces, how detailed was the depth maps that you created from that?
Pretty detailed.
You better explain to everybody what the depth map is.
Sorry. So what he's asking me is, so okay. When you create something, and how many people here are familiar with photogrammetry? So not very many. So photogrammetry, basically, what you're doing is, and I usually show some slides on this, but I didn't want to keep from your dreams, but what basically you're doing is you're taking photographs of something, right? And think of it like paint. Like if you want to paint this entire chair underneath everything, you have to get the paint everywhere. And it's the same thing. You have to take photographs everywhere. And then there are a number of programs out there that you can feed the photographs into, and they'll stitch it into volume, literally, right? So in this, so when you use photographs, they're really beautiful, high-resolution things, and you can get some really nice depth maps of everything where it's really beautiful. So when you go to a photograph like that, how do we do that? Well, I can guarantee you, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference between the photogrammetry and that depth map of our recreated Greenland section. So we did our best. Although, like, I have some gaming people who work for me, and one of them is not there anymore, but I came in and we did show Frontline thing, and I hadn't seen it yet, and they'd put in seagulls, right? Because you're coming from way above, and you go down, and like, how do you show the difference in size? And they're like, seagulls? Seagulls are from California. They're not from, you know, they don't live, these were the seagulls from, like, you know, Venice Beach, not from Greenland. So those are the kind of issues of realism. You have to be careful. You can't even, like, think, oh, I'm going to show, you know, relationship between how high you are and the size of the iceberg relative to the bird. These are things of information you want to convey, but you can't convey it with a seagull who would steal your lunch down on 25th Station in L.A. Anyway, sorry, another question here?
You started your presentation with deepfakes. Any thoughts on how to combat something like that? Because obviously photorealism is becoming more and more prevalent.
So that's why I said ending about trust. Trust is really important in this picture, right? So where did that video come from? That is going to be super important for you to check if you're going to see something and hear something. You can't, unfortunately, you can't just assume it's actually the President of the United States. You have to figure out where did that video come from, and it's why people are compiling sites like those fake news sites, right? And you need to check. You need to trust. Well, I guess I'm my president, but maybe I'll verify that. And you have to figure out where is that source? Where did it come from? And I think that's really kind of where we are right now of in terms of where what we're thinking. I think that we're going to be looking at digital imprinting. As part of the commission, there were some hardcore debates because if you want to have a ability to assess who's made something and yet protect people in situations where they're vulnerable, how do you do that? And we discussed some things like, you know, is there a way to have community blockchain that can recognize somebody's information and know them as being trusted part of the community without necessarily having to reveal their identity. And I think these are questions that we're still going to figure out, but, you know, with every good comes bad, right? That's part of the issue.
We have two more questions over here.
Yeah, the question I have is your suggestion that think before you transfer on in social media or whatever form. How do you reconcile with the fact that oftentimes in social media, you seek out the information that validates your existing belief set, and so oftentimes what you're perpetuating, since it reinforces your belief set, you're more apt to believe it's real.
So early on we started calling this cyber balkanization, right? Being balkanized from other groups. I think that one of the more interesting studies more recently was who's sharing that kind of fake information, and it tended to be people over the age of 60, I hate to say it, but it's true, who haven't been grown up in this medium and don't have at least, I think, you know, you've got your junior high schoolers who are kind of very vulnerable, but then you get an age group of kind of grown up understanding how easy it is to make and manipulate, and then you have older audiences who are sharing stuff within the groups that they know who aren't taking a look at that. So, you know, we know that the cyber balkanization thing is an issue, but one of the most important pieces is that people trust their local journalistic organizations, but they've been really dying out because of financial problems. And I think that that's something which we're hoping gets reversed, that there's some models, there's money being put into investment pools to help local journalism figure out how to reinvent itself in this new digital age, which leads back to hopefully bringing our local world as being more connected rather than disconnected, and that hopefully will help start to break that trend of just always sharing only what you believe in and going after only what you believe in. Because there are a lot of shared values, right? We have shared values. I continuously am the optimist, I know, but I have no other place to go, so I'm going to go there instead. Two other questions, I think?
Yeah,
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Hi. I was just curious, you know, one of the statements that you made is, you know, we've got to figure out how to understand the origin of the information. Are you guys looking at blockchain technologies to try to help that?
Well, that's what I was just saying, using blockchain as a way to, I think it's a great option to allow sources to add the information, be able to track where that information came from without necessarily revealing the identity of a source. And I think that provenance is so important, and that blockchain can get us further down that road. There was one experiment on blockchain of journalists, and it just didn't get the investment it needed. They're trying to relaunch right now. So I think people are beginning to experiment with blockchain for information, but just starting. I think it's pretty viable.
One last question from me. Thank you, that was wonderful. Just guessing, how long has this been around, which is relatively new, and as the second half, how fast do you think this is growing? The fear being, yes, we're working with public figures and, you know, organized crime or you know, casual criminals, but when is this, you know, my kid's spoofing the babysitter?
Now, so Reddit, there's something, it's called deepfakes. It's that technology for tracking faces and doing that got released on Reddit. So anybody and everybody can do it right now. So trust and then verify.
And growth? You think it's just taken off? Is it something also that we see? I know some of those things.
You know, I'm gonna flip that over a little bit and get through the fear, because think how much fun it would be to puppeteer, you know, your favorite character, right? So there is the fun to it. It's a matter of like how much is this gonna spread? It's gonna spread a lot. But I think we've been burned, right? I didn't get into the whole stuff that's happened with Facebook and disinformation and trolling, and you know, we've been pretty badly burned by this. And I hope that that's gonna inform the way that we think about any kind of information that comes to us. And right now there's some, like this is also a very interesting part in the commission, was this discussion on should the platforms like Google and Facebook be considered publishers? Because if they're publishers and they publish all this information, that gives them a different set of responsibility. And we, as the Knight Commission, we recommended something called that they have to have the same fiduciary duty to their publics that a doctor or an accountant or anybody else who serves the public like this, and that they should be required to meet some standards. And you know, when you're not a publisher, because they have ability to publish without being sued. But if you're not a publisher, you can do that. If you become a publisher, it changes everything. So there's some tensions along that are happening right now too.
Well, Nani, thank you so much. What a great way to close. Give a big round of applause.
Thank you so much.
And also so forward thinking, and so big, you're talking about a whole ecosystem.